watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, or WMRW Warren. And welcome listeners on 96.7 Squad FM WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last month, a report in the New York Times revealed that for more than a year, the Bush administration has been conducting a widespread program of secret and warrantless surveillance on thousands of Americans. And since the revelations, the administration has claimed the ongoing spying is within the presidential powers of conducting the so-called war on terrorism. But what has emerged is a different picture, one reminiscent of the Watergate scandal and COINTELPRO era, when the administration was caught using the apparatus of the security state to surveil and destroy political opponents and dissidents. Coming up, testimony from hearings on domestic spying by the Bush administration, which were held last Friday in Washington by Representative John Conyers and other Democrats of the House Judiciary Committee. These hearings were unofficial and thus without subpoena power and not endorsed by the Republican majority, which, not for the first time, consigned an attempt to inquire into administration misconduct to the basement of the Capitol, denying access to the elegant hearing rooms which exist for such purposes and were standing empty. This petty harassment seems meant to send a signal to the media that the hearings are not to be taken seriously and to ensure that the deliberations will not appear on television against a background of velvet and marble trappings of state. To remind us who is in charge.
Come gather round me, hear my sad story. I know you think you've heard someone sing it before me, but it's an old song, I had to change it. Times ain't what they used to be. As I was walking that super highway, below the gray haze and sooted skyway, I was arrested for hitchhiking on the freeway. They said it don't belong to me. It ain't my land, and it ain't your land. Could be a rich land, but it's a poor land, 'cause of the few that hold it in their tight grip hands, so that it don't belong to you or me. When I was younger, and in my schooling, I learned and followed by all the rulings. I never dreamed that they were only fooling. How could my teachers lie to me? But as time passed and I grew older, and the world around me got a little colder, well then a voice came calling at my shoulder. Said it don't belong to you or me. It ain't my land, and it ain't your land. Could be a rich land, but it's a poor land, 'cause of the few that hold it in their tight grip hands, so that it don't.
Now to Representative John Conyers of Michigan, ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, as he calls the hearing to order. Please excuse the occasionally crunchy sound quality.
I'm so delighted that we're all here again in the basement of the Rayburn Building, like we were in the Downing Street memos hearing. Ladies and gentlemen, there can be little doubt that we're in a constitutional crisis that threatens the system of checks and balances that have preserved our fundamental freedoms for over 200 years. There's no better illustration of that crisis than the fact that the President of the United States is violating our nation's laws by authorizing the National Security Administration, NSA, to engage in warrantless surveillance of United States citizens. The administration offers two arguments to justify their actions. First, they assert that warrantless searches were authorized by the Afghanistan Use of Force Resolution passed by Congress. And second, they say that the Constitution permits and even mandates such actions. Neither of these, I don't think, will stand close scrutiny. But to make sure that in fairness, we got the whole story, since the Attorney General had put out a 42-page memo once again defending his position, I called Attorney General Gonzalez this morning and re-invited him or his representative to come and join us here this morning to make their case. And I just want to ask, is there any representative from the Attorney General's office present in B339? Now, as for the claim of statutory authority, a plain reading of the text of the resolution to me reveals there's no reference whatsoever to domestic surveillance. And we've learned from the former Senate Majority Leader, Mr. Daschle, that the resolution had been narrowed from the administration's initial request to avoid such construction, and the Attorney General went so far as to admit that he had been advised that it would be difficult, if not impossible, for members of Congress to amend the law to avoid such a program. As Harvard constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe wrote me, to argue that no one couldn't have gotten congressional authorization after arguing previously that they had gotten congressional authorization takes some nerve. In terms of inherent constitutional authority, this also flies in the face of both common sense and legal precedent. If the Supreme Court didn't let President Truman use this authority to take over the steel mills during the Korean War in 1952, and wouldn't let President Bush use the authority to indefinitely hold enemy combatants in 2005, it's obvious the Constitution doesn't allow warrantless wiretapping of United States citizens today. As Justice O'Connor famously wrote, a state of war is not a blank check. What may be most troubling of all is that if we let domestic spying programs continue, if we let our president convince us that we are at war so that he can do what he wants, we will allow to stand the principle that the president alone can decide what laws apply to him. I submit this is not only inconsistent with the principles upon which our republic was founded, but it really denigrates the very freedom we've been fighting for since the tragic events of September 11, 2001. And so that's why we're holding today's hearings. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been honored by a very distinguished panel. Bruce Fine, our first witness, is a constitutional lawyer and an international consultant. He has been an associate deputy attorney general and general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, and we're so delighted and honored that he's here today. Mr. James Bamford, is the author of The Puzzle Palace, a national bestseller when it was first published and is now regarded as a classic. Until recently, he was the Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings and has written investigative cover stories for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post Magazine, and the Los Angeles Times Magazine. Professor Jonathan Turley, a nationally recognized legal scholar who's written extensively in areas ranging from constitutional law to legal theory to tort law. He has challenged both Democratic and Republican presidents in the course of his distinguished career. Richard Hirsch is a member and spokesman for a Florida-based Quaker organization known as the Truth Project. He has recently discovered that because of the organization's activities, it's been listed as a credible threat to the military, with a 400-page Defense Department report that NBC News obtained. And we have as well the director of the Washington Legislative Office of the American Civil Liberties Union, Ms. Carolyn Fredrickson. And we're delighted to have you here. We are aware of the recent lawsuit that has been filed in the Detroit federal courts challenging the whole episode about executive branch authority to wiretap. And Kate Martin, the director of the Center for National Security Studies. And she has testified many times before the House and Senate on issues relating to homeland security, intelligence, and civil liberties since 9/11. We are delighted, honored, and pleased that all of you have prepared yourselves to testify. If you would all stand and raise your right hand, I will ask you, do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth during these hearings?
I do. Yes, I do.
Thank you. You may sit down. We begin with Attorney Bruce Fein. Welcome and thank you again for being with us today, sir.
Well, thank you, Congressman, and other members of the Judiciary Committee. The Founding Fathers understood that men were not angels and that trust me was not a good enough protection for our civil liberties. And accordingly, they created a tripartite system of government whereby the legislature, executive, and judicial branches would be restraints upon one another. As Madison explained, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. And it's the issue of separation of power, something that is critical to the civil liberties of the living and those yet to be born, that has been raised by President Bush's justification for his unilateral decision to authorize the National Security Agency to engage in eavesdropping without warrants against American citizens, and declining to suggest that Congress has any role in the matter. One of the reasons why the issue is so critical is that we will be in a state of permanent hostilities against terrorism for our lifetimes and for the indefinite future. So the claimed authorities of the president are not temporary. They will not go away. They will become permanent fixtures of the political and legal landscape, which is one reason why we must focus so clearly and sharply on the justifications. Secondly, the president's claims do not distinguish in principle from intercepting a communication between a U.S. citizen in the United States and abroad, or a communication wholly within the United States, because the gist of his authority that he claims is that if the purpose of the interception or surveillance is to advance or help defeat terrorism, then he can do it on his say-so alone without any consideration of what Congress has enacted. For example, we know that the 9/11 perpetrators were within the United States prior to the attacks, and communication that they would have would be solely within the United States. They may have communicated with an American citizen. There's nothing in the president's claim of authority to surveil and to wiretap to further the war against terrorism, that would restrict his authority to only what he says he's doing now, surveilling or intercepting communications between the United States and abroad. The implausibility of the president's claim seems to be self-evident. In 1978, following congressional hearings of abuse of executive authority in spying on Americans, mail openings, for example, Congress decided to cut a balance between civil liberties and national security. And they struck that balance also in considering wartime, the type the president confronted after 9/11. And the Congress concluded that there would be a 15-day window when the president would not need a judicial warrant that might be too slow and clumsy in order to protect the Americans from any imminent repeat attack. And, of course, after 9/11, we didn't know whether there were sleeper cells. At one time, Congress had thought about a one-year automatic extension, but rejected that with the idea the president can come quickly, and we can consider extending that period, even altering the standard in a short time frame. Moreover, the history of the Congress is one that shows that proceedings can be in secret. The Manhattan Project, for example, was conducted and executed without any leaks to the enemy. And the first Senate sat 6 years without any openness. There is no reason why the president couldn't have come if he thought it was necessary to arrange to have a debate and have an amendment to FISA without revealing all secrets to the enemy. Indeed, FISA itself recognized that the obvious. Our enemy recognizes that we will use surveillance and wiretapping to try to collect intelligence. And I don't think it's plausible to believe that any kind of discussion in theory that the president has extraordinary powers to surveil in wartime would permit the enemy to evade any kind of particular practice. But anyway, the Congress explicitly addressed the idea of the powers of the president during wartime and wiretapping. The authorization of force statute doesn't refer to FISA. The administration's claims that it sub silentio overruled FISA is on its face implausible. The rule of statutory construction for centuries is the more specific statute overrides the more general one. And I don't think anything more needs to be said about the fact that he is violating FISA. I think it's even more worrisome to understand the claims he is making of inherent constitutional authority to undertake any efforts for the purpose of defeating terrorism, irrespective of congressional action or otherwise. For instance, under his interpretation of the authorization for force, he could suspend the writ of habeas corpus, which he hasn't done, saying, this authorization enabled me to do anything in furtherance of the war effort. I can suspend the writ of habeas corpus unilaterally, even though Congress hasn't done so. It would suggest as well that in the amendment that Senator McCain sponsored, prohibiting inhumane, cruel, or degrading interrogation, that really is an unconstitutional encroachment on his powers, because if he thinks that kind of treatment is helpful to defeating terrorism, he can engage in it irrespective of what the statute says. It would suggest that the Lindsey Graham Amendment, regulating the civilian review tribunals in Guantanamo Bay, also are unconstitutional, because the president may decide that those kinds of oversight is too great an intrusion on his ability to extract intelligence and separate out the real enemy from those who wouldn't pose a danger, and therefore he could ignore that statute. The president could claim on his customary incident of war he could put people in concentration camps, as was done in World War II, claiming these are people who are likely to be spies and saboteurs and aiders of Al-Qaeda. I don't need a warrant, and since Roosevelt did in World War II, I can do it now. He could authorize breaking and entering of homes in order to secure intelligence to fight the war against terrorism, despite the fact there's an authorized procedure in an amendment to FISA that governs physical searches. Now, the principle that the president has established here, if gone unchecked, will, as Justice Robert Jackson said, lie around like a loaded gun and be utilized by any future incumbent who claims a need. And the history of power teaches us one thing, that if it's unchecked, it will be abused. There will be overreaching. Whether or not you have a benevolent individual or someone who's malevolent, that is the nature of power. As Lord Acton said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and we ought not to risk that when there are absolutely clear, legal, responsible ways to fight terrorism with all the aggressiveness that we need. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Attorney Bruce Fine. We now turn to Mr. James Bamford. Welcome to the hearings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. In the short time that I have, I think it might be useful just to discuss a little bit of the events that led up to the creation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, how it applies to NSA, and the dangers of violating that law. Those dangers were foreseen many years ago by Senator Frank Church, the Idaho Democrat who led the investigation into the abuses of the intelligence agencies in 1975. Following his probe, Senator Church came away very shocked and warned very dramatically about the dangers that might befall the country if NSA was ever turned loose. He said the agency's technological capability, quote, at any time could be turned around on the American public, and no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge of this country, the technological capability that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know, such as the capability of that technology, unquote. When Senator Church spoke those words, it was three decades ago. Today, the NSA's capability has increased enormously. Back then, there were all the NSA was able to do was to eavesdrop on hardline telephones and some occasional telegrams. Today, the NSA is the largest intelligence agency on Earth and by far the most dangerous if not subjected to strict laws and oversight. It has the ability to virtually get into someone's mind. It can read a person's most private thoughts expressed in email correspondence sent from their home computer, eavesdrop on their cell telephones as they drive to work, read the messages from their BlackBerry as they ride the elevator, and then listen in on their office telephone and monitor their computer and fax machine as they conduct business. NSA was created back in 1952, and it was created in absolute secrecy as opposed to the CIA, which was formed by an act of Congress. NSA was created by a top-secret memorandum signed by President Truman. And the existence of NSA, just the existence of it, was kept totally secret for almost a decade. At the very beginning, NSA made a secret agreement with the heads of the various telegraph companies, including Western Union, whereby the companies would secretly give to NSA, virtually every night they would give to NSA, an employee of NSA, all the cables that went through the company during that day. And that went on for about 30 years. NSA got the secret, got these messages very secretly from Western Union and the other companies, and there were only a handful of people in the companies that knew that this was going on. Then during the Watergate period, President Nixon turned NSA's giant ear inward during the Watergate affair. He was concerned about the growing anti-Vietnam protest movement, and so he called the director of NSA into his office and ordered him to begin eavesdropping domestically on American citizens, very much the same way President Bush did more recently. President Nixon ordered Admiral Noel Geiler, who was director at the time, to begin listening to Americans, and among those people were anti-war protesters, Joan Baez, Dr. Benjamin Spock was one of the people listened to, Dr. Martin Luther King. They began expanding and expanding, which is really the nature of this type of eavesdropping. And eventually they began eavesdropping on authors, two authors who were planning to write books on NSA. They began eavesdropping on. They put them on the watch list. Following the discovery of these things by the Church Committee and also by the Rockefeller Commission, the Justice Department began a very, very secret criminal investigation of NSA. It began... it was probably the only time an entire agency was looked at as a potential criminal defendant. Miranda rights were read to the senior officials of NSA, and they spent over a year looking into the possible criminal prosecution of people at NSA. In the end, the Justice Department investigation decided against prosecution because they felt that there would be too many secrets revealed in court. Nevertheless, they did find 23 categories of questionable activities. But what they did decide to do instead of actually prosecuting was they recommended that Congress create some new laws that will actually make this a real violation of law. At the time, it was fairly gray area because there were no laws in this area. So a year later, Congress created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And paramount in that legislation was preventing future presidents from doing what Richard Nixon did, secretly ordering NSA's giant ear turned inwards on American citizens. At that time, testifying before the House Intelligence Committee, the Attorney General, Griffin Bell, made that very clear. He said, quote, "I would particularly call your attention to the improvements in this bill over a similar measure proposed in the last Congress. First, the current bill recognizes no inherent power of the president to conduct electronic surveillance, whereas the bill introduced last year contained an explicit reservation of presidential power for electronic surveillance within the United States. This bill specifically states that the procedures in the bill are the exclusive means by which electronic surveillance, as defined in the bill, and the interception of domestic wire and oral communications may be conducted." That really leaves no avenue for a president except for going through the FISA court. The problem you have here is among the people that can be listened to, once it's taken from the FISA court judges and given to a shift supervisor at NSA, are virtually anybody. And again, they could start turning these, turning the NSA's giant ear on the American public. NSA has an enormous eavesdropping facility for pulling in 2 million communications an hour at each listening post. So you're talking about a giant amount of communications being brought in. And once a person's in that database, there's virtually no way to get out. It's like India Inc. You're in there forever. And no matter if this president is listening to people he feels that are opposed to his administration, there's no telling that when the next administration comes in that they will turn the giant ear on somebody that they may feel is opposed. So there's a very strong need to for this committee to take a very close look at NSA and the president's violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bamford. As I predicted, Congressman Jerry Nadler came in from New York and is with us now. We appreciate your great effort this morning to be with us. I'm now pleased to recognize Professor Jonathan Turley.
Thank you, sir, and thank you and your colleagues for inviting me here to speak today with such a distinguished panel. The disclosure on December 16th, 2005, of the NSA operation has pushed this country deep into a constitutional crisis, and one that there are frankly few parallels in our history. Our system of government rests on a certain axis, a balance of power, of a tripartite system, three branches, none of which have the authority to govern alone. In that system, the very scourge is a maximum leader. It runs against the constitutional grain. It creates a dangerous imbalance. President Bush has, for many years, asserted authority that is both absolute and, in my view, quite dangerous. In August 1st, 2002, there was the infamous torture memo that was put out by the Justice Department that stated in significant part that the president could indeed order government officials to violate federal law. In fact, that memo said that imposing a limitation on his ability to conduct exercises or people to conduct exercises that would constitute torture would be an unconstitutional infringement upon his inherent authority. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, in his confirmation hearings, insisted that he was rejecting that memo, although at the time we now know he was aware of an NSA operation that was based precisely on the same claim of authority. The president has also claimed authority in enemy combatant cases to unilaterally declare a citizen to be an enemy combatant, to strip him entirely of his constitutional rights, including the right of access to counsel in the courts. Then December 30th, just recently, 2005, the president signed the torture bill that was enacted by this body and by the Senate. When he did so, he used what was a signing reservation, a signing statement, where he reserved the right to violate that law if he considered it to be in the nation's interest. Now we know that there is an NSA operation based upon the same extreme theory of presidential power. The problem with these claims is that they're devoid of any limiting principle. They place this country on a slippery slope that inevitably leads to a maximum leader. Now, I read the document that was put out yesterday by the Department of Justice, and I have changed my written testimony to address that document, and I've given copies of a longer statement to this body. If there's any doubt about how extreme these claims are, I suggest you read that document. But frankly, what is most remarkable is not the sweeping claims of authority, but the conspicuous lack of authority to support those claims. Now, in our system of separation of powers, the framers designed what was a unique system, a system where no government, no branch could govern alone. That creates an inherent tension that is healthy for a democratic process. There's never been a president that didn't want to be Congress. Frankly, there's never been a Congress that didn't want to be president. And frankly, we've had judges that wanted to be both at times. But all of these branches have an institutional integrity and interest. And so they protect that delicate balance. The Supreme Court has rejected the very claims being made by the president with regard to the NSA operation. This operation falls under what Justice Jackson referred to as the lowest possible ebb in terms of executive authority. It is in direct contradiction of FISA. Now, I want to be absolutely clear. What the president ordered in this case was a crime. Now, we can debate whether he had a good or bad motivation, but it was a crime. The federal law makes it clear you cannot engage in this type of surveillance, in a domestic surveillance operation, without committing a crime, that you can go to jail for 5 years. Now, we can debate the wisdom of that. We can debate why the president may have done it. But in my view, the president committed a crime. And we have to deal with that as citizens. And unfortunately, you have to deal with that as members of Congress. It gives me no pleasure to say that. But it also strikes me as an alarming circumstance when the president can go on into a press conference and announce that he has violated a federal statute 30 times and promises to continue to do so until someone stops him. That's the most remarkable admission I've ever heard from a president of the United States. Now, the federal law is clear because of the exclusivity provision under Title III. Title III says quite clearly that all surveillance done domestically must be done pursuant to Title III or to FISA. And then FISA makes it a crime to engage in this type of surveillance without a court order. Now, this is the most user-friendly law a president has ever been given. FISA virtually is devoid of a basis to turn down the president. That's why we've had over 13,000 FISA applications and only a handful of denials. When I first went into the FISA court, as a lowly intern at the NSA, frankly, it started a lifetime opposition for me to that court. I was shocked with what I saw. I was convinced that the judge in that skiff would have signed anything that we put in front of him. And I wasn't entirely sure that he had actually read what we put in front of him. But I remember going back to my supervisor at NSA and saying, that place scares the daylights out of me. And my supervisor said something interesting. He said, you know what? It is scary. But we're here. The lawyers of the NSA. I was a law student at that time. And we won't let things happen. We won't let a president exceed his authority. Well, this president has exceeded his authority. Under FISA, there are three exceptions that allow the president to, in one case, engage in surveillance and proceed later to get approval. The suggestion that time is of the essence is a ludicrous one. I have reduced white paper by the Justice Department into five central claims, all of which, frankly, I believe is meritless. The first and most important is that the president has inherent authority to violate federal law and the Fourth Amendment. That is the most dangerous claim of all. Historically, our most serious wounds as a nation have been self-inflicted wounds. They've been done when we've been afraid. They've not been done by external evil forces. We did it to ourselves. And the way that that happens is when we remain passive and silent in the face of unchecked authority. If you take a look at these claims, and I won't go through them because time is limited here, I will simply remind this institution of its duty. The framers believed that despite any affiliation to the president, Congress would jealously protect its authority. It's a duty to protect a legacy that you were given and all citizens were given. What's at stake is not a president who has committed crimes. It's much more serious than that. What's at stake is a president who is committing crimes in a name or a pretense of legality. He is saying that he has the authority to do that. Now, members that stay silent are making a choice. Very few members have faced this type of test of faith, but you're facing it now. And as citizens and in members, it's now up to us. We're called to account. To the many benefits that we have gotten from this system, we're called to account to do something and to not to remain silent. And I thank you very much for inviting me today.
Thank you, Mr. Turley. We now turn to Mr. Richard Hirsch, and we welcome you to these proceedings.
Good afternoon, Congressman Conyers and other esteemed members of the House. I thank you for including me on such an august body of expert witnesses. I can only conclude that I'm the expert in being spied upon. My name is Richard Hirsch. I'm a 59-year-old male with a painful neurological condition that severely limits my physical abilities. I've traveled from Florida to Washington to advise you of the enormous amount of surveillance and disruption of peaceful groups by agents of the Bush administration. In November of 2004, people who represented an association of religious, educational, environmental, peace, and social justice activists met at the Quaker Meeting House in Lake Worth, Florida. This group formed the Truth Project Incorporated, a Florida nonprofit corporation whose purpose is to help educate high school students and their parents about military service and to give them enough accurate information to make informed choices about critical decisions. As a group, we are various ages, sexes, ethnicities, creeds, and political philosophies, but we are all proud Americans. The Quakers welcomed us into their church because they believed our intent was nonviolent and was in keeping in their deeply felt beliefs of teaching peace and understanding. They knew our purpose was solely to exercise our First Amendment rights to assemble peaceably, to speak freely, and worship as we choose. We had no idea until 1 year later that the unfamiliar faces in the church had been sent by the President's Department of Defense to spy on us. NBC News investigators showed us the agents of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group from Fort Meade, Maryland, where the National Security Agency is headquartered, infiltrated the Quaker Meeting House, and then filed a report designating us a credible threat. The President's agents did not come to worship alongside us, to help us plan our educational program, or to protect us. And it wasn't just us. Shortly after NBC aired its report, churches and other groups began sharing their experiences of infiltration and intimidation with us. St. Maurice's Catholic Church in Dania, the Unitarian Universalists, the Fort Lauderdale Friends, members of Pax Christi in West Palm Beach, environmental groups, and many others. Agents rummaged through trash, attacked and snooped into email, hacked websites, and listened in on phone conversations. Indeed, address books and activist meeting lists have disappeared. President Bush tells us only a few phone calls are listened to. But that's not true. Mr. Bush says they only monitor calls to foreign countries, but that is absolutely untrue. He tells us he spies only on known Al-Qaeda contacts or affiliates, but I know for a fact that is not true because I was spied on in a house of worship in the United States and in private homes in Florida, where I was meeting with other peaceful persons engaged in constitutionally protected activity. I have reason to believe that the federal government listens to my phone calls to family members and friends about purely personal matters. I have every reason to believe that the president's agents read my email, photograph me as I exercise my constitutional rights, record the license numbers of cars I ride in, and create huge databases with information about me and my fellow activists, because all of this specific activity is on record from government files as having been visited on American citizens around the United States by members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the FBI, the NSA, and other agencies. If, as George Orwell once said, in times of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act, we members of the Truth Project Incorporated must be revolutionaries. I thought Congress passed safeguards against indiscriminate domestic spying after the gross violations of citizens' rights during the Civil Rights Movement and Vietnam peace activism. But here we are again, like the Church Commission. Today, I think President Bush should confess the true extent of his domestic spying program. Confession is good for the soul. I think he should tell us the truth. That truth should set us all free.
Actually, you had a minute when I raised my hand if you wanted to continue on.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for turning back your time, Mr. Hirsch, and thank you for your testimony. Attorney Carolyn Fredrickson, American Civil Liberties Union.
Congressman Conyers, distinguished members of the panel, thank you very much for having the ACLU to speak at this, the first of what I hope is many congressional hearings into the NSA's classified program of warrantless domestic spying. And Congressman Conyers, we applaud you for your dedication to civil liberties and the rule of law. And I think this hearing could not come at a more appropriate time, falling within the week of the Martin Luther King Day. As you know, Dr. Martin Luther King was perhaps the most famous victim of the out-of-control national security surveillance conducted by the government in the 50s and 60s. Supposedly to fight communism, the FBI illegally wiretapped, spied on, and eventually tried to blackmail one of this nation's greatest citizens. I'd like to make three short points today about the NSA surveillance. First of all, Congress must hold more such hearings. The White House must be held accountable and the Congress must perform a critical role in this scheme of checks and balances. I also would call on the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel to investigate the program. The American people deserve to know how our rights were violated, and that won't happen unless someone independent of the president runs the investigation. Second, I urge lawmakers from both sides of the aisle to reject specious arguments being made by the White House to justify the spying. Third, and most significant, as we've already heard today, it's crucial to remember that this is not an isolated incident. The Bush administration has a long record of hostility to basic constitutional norms and democratic values. The clearest indication of the White House's disdain for fundamental American freedoms, aside from this scandal, has to be the Patriot Act. For more than 4 years, reasonable men and women from both sides of the aisle have called on the White House to accept very modest changes to the Patriot Act to better balance national security and constitutional liberties. The answer has been a categorical no. In addition, again, as we've already heard today, the Pentagon has been spying and maintaining files on Americans, exercising their First Amendment rights. And so is the FBI. As part of an ACLU FOIA effort in 20 states on behalf of over 100 domestic, political, and religious groups, the ACLU received numerous documents confirming that the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Forces are investigating peaceful activists working on issues from affirmative action, animal rights, environmental rights, to opposition to the Iraq War. This is the same administration that had retired Rear Admiral John Poindexter develop the Total Information Awareness data mining system at the Pentagon. That program was supposed to track in real time the electronic footprints of every individual in the United States. The administration also proposed Operation TIPS, which would have recruited postal workers and cable technicians to be snoops for the government. And the list goes on. Torture, eavesdropping on attorney-client conversations, implementing an air travel system called CAPS-2 that promises to tar millions of innocent air travelers as potential terrorists, including, as we know, small children and infants, actively seeking to paint its critics as traitors, secretly deporting suspects to countries that use torture as an interrogation technique, rounding up thousands of non-citizens after 9/11 on the weakest of leads, aggressively using what should be limited anti-terrorism powers to sidestep traditional checks and balances, and creating, arguably, the most secretive administration this country has ever known. The NSA scandal is only the latest in a long line of abuses. I would also like to remind everyone here just why we now require judicial supervision of national security surveillance. First, historically, the executive branch has repeatedly used vague claims of national security to justify the sabotage of its political rivals. For instance, many would point to J. Edgar Hoover's deep dislike of Dr. King as the reason for the smear campaign against him. And second, without a neutral decision-maker keeping tabs on wiretaps, physical searches, and other invasions of privacy, overeager agents push the limits. In the Cold War, legitimate concerns about Soviet espionage morphed into a wholesale snoop campaign into the lives of activists and intellectuals who had nothing whatsoever to do with our national security. And third, because of that tendency to overreach, judicial supervision actually enhances national security by focusing limited investigative resources on real threats. As the New York Times reported last weekend, the NSA surveillance flooded the FBI with thousands and thousands of useless tips. And according to the story, it got so bad that the agents said they were actually spending time pursuing what were turned out to be a lot of calls to Pizza Hut. And as we know, this country has had numerous other examples of scandals involving warrantless security under the false banner of national security. In the years following the Russian Revolution, the FBI used the Red Scare to infiltrate labor groups, round up immigrants, and ruin innocent lives. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, the CIA, and the U.S. military conducted a dizzying array of programs in the United States to hunt down subversives, all of which allegedly were justified by the Cold War, but had little or nothing to do with fighting it. These programs invariably spied on, harassed, and kept dossiers on labor leaders, civil rights workers, and students opposed to the Vietnam War. Now, there is a growing public outcry against the NSA's warrantless surveillance. Polls show that not only is the public wary of the NSA's actions, it's aware of the depth of the scandal. Two-thirds of respondents in a recent poll said they were following this story closely. This week, the ACLU filed suit on behalf of a distinguished group of plaintiffs, including journalists, scholars, and advocates, whose work makes them obvious targets of illegal NSA wiretapping. We are challenging the program under the First and Fourth Amendments, and we argue that it violates longstanding separation of powers principles. Before I conclude, I'd like to just make one more point to correct the record on a key issue. While the ACLU has compared the NSA surveillance to Watergate, I want to make very clear that the NSA surveillance is, by the president's own admission, far more extensive than that at issue in Watergate. As Nixon's White House counsel John Dean wrote last month, here, Bush may have outdone Nixon. In closing, I urge Congress to continue to investigate this warrantless surveillance, and I urge the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel. Thank you again for inviting me.
Thank you so much. Attorney Kate Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Representative Conyers, and I want to thank all of the distinguished members of the House of Representatives for holding this hearing. I want to echo the remarks made by people today about the abdication of the constitutional responsibilities of the House of Representatives in failing to hold any formal hearings. And such formal hearings, which would conduct oversight over this program, are necessary not only to protect our basic civil liberties, but in addition to ensure that the departments of the inside the executive branch are in fact engaging in effective counterterrorism activities and not once again going down the path looking at easy and perhaps politically unpopular targets while missing those who would actually do us harm, and that oversight, which the House of Representatives to date has refused to engage in, is necessary for both purposes. I want to elaborate just for a moment on the legal analysis presented to before you today by my colleagues here on this panel and make just a couple of points. First, that as has been pointed out, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in three different ways prohibits the president from conducting wiretapping outside of the four corners of that act and the criminal wiretap statute. And in fact, this specific issue of whether or not the president had inherent authority to conduct warrantless wiretaps outside of those statutes was considered during the 2 years in which Congress debated and then enacted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and expressly rejected by the Congress at the time. The president signed the bill, and there was no statement that that limitation was unconstitutional. The president now argues that to the extent that the FISA prohibits the president from engaging in warrantless wiretapping outside of its procedures, it is unconstitutional. In deciding that claim, I agree that it's a specious claim, but I think that we can look more specifically to the text of the Constitution. Fundamentally, their argument goes that as the president is acting here as commander-in-chief to respond to the 9/11 attacks, and as commander-in-chief, he has the sole power to make certain kinds of decisions. In my judgment, that's true. For example, when and where to attack in Afghanistan is a matter on which Congress, once the attacks in Afghanistan have been authorized, can have nothing to say. What kinds of troops to insert into a specific place is a matter within the president's commander-in-chief authority. But the question of whom and when to wiretap on Americans inside the United States is a matter that the Constitution specifically commits to more than one branch when, in the Fourth Amendment, it states that searches and seizures require a warrant, and that warrant is to be issued by the judiciary branch. So the claim here of inherent authority is structurally contradicted by the Constitution itself, which says that the power to conduct searches and seizures belongs in part to the judiciary, as well as to the Congress, which here has set the standards for the judiciary to apply in issuing warrants. I think it's necessary, and we should not forget, that it is not simply a claim that the president has the sole power to decide which laws to violate and when to go outside the judicial power, but that he has the power to do so in secret. Remember that until the New York Times revealed this program, he withheld the fact from the American people that his view was that FISA did not limit his powers. He secretly believed that he had broader authority than was laid out in the public statutes, but he withheld and misled the American people about that view of his own powers. And that's evidenced in the statement that Representative Scott quoted, but it is again evidenced in many of the testimonies that were put before the House of Representatives in connection with the Patriot Act. One thing I would urge you to do is to examine what kinds of misleading statements, if not deceptions, were put before the Congress in connection with this program, we were assured repeatedly that Americans' privacy was safe because there were checks and balances in place and the administration was following the law. We all understood the law to be that which was publicly enacted when it turned out that the administration, with a wink and a nod, has apparently deemed there to be some kind of secret law and then misled the American people and the Congress in what that law and what those authorities were. Just one final comment on that. The president has claimed that the secrecy was necessary for national security reasons to prevent al-Qaeda from knowing that we were wiretapping them. That claim is absurd on its face, I submit to you. From day one, before 9/11, al-Qaeda knew that we were trying to wiretap them, as we should be doing. Al-Qaeda knew that the Patriot Act was about amending the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to make it easier to wiretap on al-Qaeda. It makes no difference to al-Qaeda whether or not they're being wiretapped with a warrant or without a warrant. It makes a difference to the American people whether or not the president is engaging in wiretaps of Americans without a warrant. And that, I submit to you, is most likely the justification for keeping this program secret. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Kate Martin, director of the National Center for Security Studies, testifying on Bush administration wiretaps on Americans at a hearing held last Friday in Washington, chaired by Representative John Conyers, ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, RadioVeronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We return to the hearing as John Conyers introduces the questioning of the witnesses.
I'd like to begin with our distinguished member from New York, and I'm very delighted and pleased to recognize Jerry Nadler at this time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I regard, and I've looked into and I've read it, you know, the stuff that the people here have put out and others, the legal arguments the administration makes are not even debatable. They're frivolous arguments. They are arguments that could only be made by a monarch, by someone who is trying to justify absolute power in the executive branch. And as I read what they think the president can do, the president and Professor Turley said that the arguments of the Justice Department have no limits. They would empower. There is no limiting principle. And as I read their arguments, the president would have the inherent power to order a hitman to walk in and murder anybody sitting in this room if he, in his sole discretion, thought that would help national security, and he would be accountable to no one for that judgment. That cannot be the law in the United States. Absolute power cannot be the law in the United States. As I read the statements by the Justice Department, the power the president claims he has, if he were in Germany in 1933, he would not have required the Enabling Act to pass the Reichstag to claim the power. He is claiming absolute power that no one in American history has ever claimed. This cannot stand. This cannot, and it's far beyond the question of the just this warrantless surveillance.